Hello, I'm your host Inman Narowin, and this is Strangers in a Tangled Wilderness, a monthly podcast of anarchic literature, where we take our monthly zine and turn it into an audio feature and interview the author. You can get a copy of the monthly zine by signing up for our Patreon at patreon.com/strangersinatangledwilderness, or you can read along for free at tangledwilderness.org. This month we have Hurrah for Anarchy, A History of Haymarket, May Day, and the Chicago Anarchists by Margaret Kiljoy, which is a short historical article about May Day, the Haymarket, and the Chicago Anarchists. I could tell you about how cool May Day is right now, but you should listen to Margaret and I talk about it in this interview instead. We have no audio feature this month, just an interview with Margaret about the zine, which you should go and read on our website, tangledwilderness.org. Check it out for free. The word of the month is about the nature of fear. Enjoy. Hello, and thank you so much for coming on the show today. Would you like to introduce yourself with your name, pronouns, and just a little bit about who you are and what you do in the world, this person that everyone, including me, is very unfamiliar with?
I'm Margaret Kiljoy. I use she and they pronouns, and I am the author of this week's featured zine of month's zine, featured zine of Strangers in the Tangled Wilderness. And my hobbies include recovering from oral surgery, complaining about recovering from oral surgery, observing remaining wisdom teeth with trepidation, and mispronouncing regularly used words. Those are my general interests.
Yay, these are all great interests, you know? You also are quite, I feel like a large interest of yours is May Day, you know? And
that's
which
true.
Is, you know, which is what we're here to talk about. And I will admit that I have been kind of like I've been tardy in my like understanding of like some pretty key historical events in anarchist history, which like kind of famously, like I didn't learn a single thing about the Spanish Civil War until I co-adapted and directed a play about the Spanish Civil War. And now I feel like a goddamn expert. But similarly, I didn't really know that much about May Day until your Cool People episode about May Day. And then I was like, holy crap, why don't I know this? What is wrong with me?
That's a good question. You should go see an anarchist doctor and they can diagnose you with historical amnesia. I don't know. Something clever here.
Something clever. Diagnosed with tardiness to history.
Yeah. Those with no knowledge of history aren't compelled to repeat it. That's the classic reason to study history.
Yeah. But that's, you know, that we're all here now to learn a little bit more about May Day, which I know I think you kind of have kind of like a spiel that you're just gonna run us through, right? You're just gonna tell us about May Day.
I'm gonna tell you the story of fucking May Day.
Hell yeah. There's love, there's a bomb, there's dead cops, there's some really wonderful speeches, there's even a trial, right?
Well, May 1st is the International Workers' Holiday. Everywhere in the world, except for one country. Can you guess what country it is?
Is it the country we live in?
It is, and it's also the country that May Day comes from. Because, well, I'm not going to get into the history of Labor Day because I don't have my notes about that in front of me. But everywhere else picked May 1st as the workers' holiday, and the U.S. was like, we don't like all that communism. We have Labor Day instead. And that's fine, whatever, because we can still just do May Day. And May Day is the workers' holiday, but the other thing about it, and it actually is what it is used for in the U.S., and this rules, is that it's an immigrant rights day. And I would argue, just to come out the gate salty, May Day has been heavily recuperated by authoritarian socialism, and specifically tankies, and specifically the USSR. And that's because the USSR was incredibly culturally impactful all over the world, and it celebrated May Day. However, May Day is very explicitly a holiday that is celebrated and remembered because of some people who were killed very explicitly by the state for being anarchists. They were not accused of any other crime. They were convicted of murder, but at no point during the trial for their murder trial was any evidence introduced claiming that they actually committed a murder. And they were found guilty and they were hanged for very explicitly being anarchists. But the other thing about it is that they were almost all immigrants. And the labor struggle of the 19th century can very easily be understood as an immigrant rights struggle. I think it's one of the reasons why the labor unions of the 20th century in the U.S. are so lackluster and boring, is that they're so afraid of any kind of, like, precarious labor and, like, immigrant labor and, like, undocumented folks and stuff like that, that it, like, it defeats the entire fucking purpose of labor organizing, as far as I'm concerned. And
yeah,
so I will say that it's not, no one's like, when authoritarian socialists claim the day as theirs, they have less ground to stand on than when undocumented folks aren't even talking about labor, but are instead talking about immigration. So, without further ado, there's going to be more ado. There's a lot of ado in this. There's much ado about May Day. That's my Shakespeare joke for the day. It's the only one I'll make because I don't know any Shakespeare. But
it's definitely not about nothing.
That's true.
Yeah.
So we celebrate May Day because in the 1880s, there was this huge, vibrant anarchist and other socialist and, like, working class scene in Chicago and all over the country that got involved in the fight for the 8-hour workday. And the featured zine that you all might have in front of you, but you might not, because you might not yet subscribe to Strangers in a Tangled Wilderness, but you can actually go, all of it's online. It starts with by talking about some of the people who ended up martyrs, and, well, one martyr and one widow of a martyr. And I like the widow of the martyr, my favorite. It's like my favorite person from this whole thing, so I'm going to start with her. There's a woman named Lucy Parsons, and you lived in, like, Boston at some point, right?
Yeah, I used to volunteer volunteer, be part of, et cetera. Hard to tell what these words mean. The Lucy Parsons Center, which was, like, the little, like, bookstore in JP.
It's still around, isn't it?
I believe so.
There's a lot of stuff named after Lucy Parsons, including a park in Chicago that I haven't been to yet. Lucy Parsons, as I run this podcast called Cool People Did Cool Stuff, and I study all this history of, like, social movements and things like that. And this woman, Lucy Parsons, her fingerprints are on everything, because she is going to go on after today's story to be one of the founders of the Industrial Workers of the World, and is one of the, like, most experienced of those organizers, right? Founding the Industrial Workers of the World. And I used to think the Industrial Workers of the World, who are still around, I used to think they were kind of like, oh, they're the, like, half anarchist union and they're okay or whatever. And the more I read history, the more I realize the Industrial Workers of the World changed everything around the world. Their model of industrial organizing. Okay, this is a thing that I got wrong for a really long time. I thought industrial organizing meant, like, industrial as in, like, people who make rivets or like listen to coil. And it turns out industrial organizing means back in the day, your union would be like, you'd have the coal shovelers union, and it would be separate from the conductors union, and it would be separate from the track layers union, and all of the different parts of the railroad have different unions. So they had a harder time doing solidarity with each other. Industrial organizing is saying entire industry, the entire rail workers. And then even beyond that, they were like, actually, what if we just put the whole fucking working class into a union? And the only people who aren't allowed in are cops, private security guards, and anyone with hiring and firing power, I think was the rules. All of this comes way after May Day, but it's influenced by May Day. this spread all over the world. And partly it's because, like, in the U.S., they were the fighting union, and they were, like, getting into gunfights all over the place. And they were specifically the anti-racist union. And they were the ones who were organizing very heavily Chinese workers on the West Coast and Mexican workers down closer in the border areas, when no one else would touch those places because everyone else is a bunch of fucking racists. And so this union that did all of this stuff, and then its ideas spread. Its ideas spread fucking everywhere. The Irish Revolution, the reason Ireland won its independence from England, James Connolly was this socialist who, like, kind of didn't fall into a lot of authoritarian socialist traps because his socialism had come out of the IWW, which was not authoritarian socialism because it was so heavily influenced by anarchism. It wasn't an anarchist union. It had a lot of anarchists in it. James Connolly changed everything about Irish history. And then I'm running across all of these wobblies, like getting involved in stuff that leads to the Russian Revolution, and just, like, all over the world, they change shit. And so I'm going to trace, because I love red strings traced all over the board, I'm going to trace everything to Lucy Parsons. And that means I'm going to trace everything to a formerly enslaved Black and Indigenous woman who was an anarchist. And Lucy Parsons, she's kind of famous for her fiery rhetoric, and, like, that she was, like, when she was, like, old as shit, she would go up and give these speeches, and she'd be like, "What I want is for every greasy, grimy tramp to arm himself with a knife or a gun and, stationing himself at the homes of the rich, stab or shoot them as they come out."
Yeah, just harder than anyone else, which, yeah. I feel like, I don't know, my experience with some, like border, like, aid organizers down here, a lot of whom, it's like the split, it's either people in their 70s or like people in their, like, early 20s and 30s. Yeah. You know, that's the split. And it's like the some of the older people were always, like, the hardest about what to do, which was, like, very unexpected to me when I was, like, 22. You know, right. I was like, shit, I don't want to go do that. That sounds scary. And this, like, 70-year-old woman's like, I don't care what they do to me.
Yeah. And it makes sense, partly because, like, a lot of our generation came up through subculture directly into anarchism or directly into radical politics. Lucy Parsons and a lot of people of this era of, like, the 1870s, 1880s started off more moderate. And so what happened with Lucy Parsons, she was born, she had a lot of different, there's a lot of different historians claiming a lot of different names for her. She actually denied her Black heritage, and this was a primarily a legal thing, I think. But she kind of wasn't fooling anyone. She eventually, after the Civil War, after she's freed, we don't know the circumstances of exactly how she became free. This actually might be part of why she doesn't fucking talk about it. She married this white dude named Albert Parsons. And Albert Parsons is also fascinating because, like, here's your redemption love story, right? Albert Parsons was, like, kind of raised blue blood, but, like, the poor aristocratic version of blue blood in America. He's, like, born in Alabama, but his, like, parents died young, and he was raised by his older brother. And he was kind of poor, but his family traces back to the Mayflower. And they're all, like, conservative as shit, right?
Yeah.
And so he's, like, working for the super conservative newspaper when he's, like, 13 or 14. And he's living in Waco, Texas, which is only famous for Albert Parsons. And it's the only reason I've ever heard of
nothing
Waco.
Else.
No, I can't think of anything else. And the Civil War breaks out, and he's, like, 14, and he's, like, not afraid. So he goes and he volunteers for the Confederate Army. And he fights, like, through the entire war. He fights for 3 years. He fights in the cavalry. He fights in the infantry. He fights in the artillery. And then he, like, gets out at 17 as this, like, war-wizened fucking veteran of an evil army. And then he's like, oh, fuck, that was the wrong side. And he immediately, there's a reason we don't hold children culpable for their actions, right?
Yeah.
He immediately, as an adult, starts fighting for racial integration and racial justice in the South. Like, and when I say fighting, I mean, he did a lot of like organizing. He went around with a lot of like black speakers and talked as like, hey, we should all do this stuff. He read a newspaper that was like, what if we all vote Republican? Which back in the day meant like anti-racist. It's a, everything got backwards at some point. and he did all this work, right? And then they like shot him for it because they were like, well, we don't like you. And they like at one point, like a crowd like pushed him down the stairs. Another time they like shot him in the leg. And he was a moderate, right? He was just like, hey, we should not be racists, you know? And
yeah, such a high bar.
I know. And so people were real mad at him. And then he married this black woman. And their marriage was not legal because miscegenation, anti-miscegenation laws, right? And so they moved to Chicago, where it actually still wasn't legal for another year because 1874 or something like that is when they when Illinois allows black and white people to get legally married. They moved to Chicago. They have two kids together. And they're like moderates. And then they become moderate socialists, right? But then there's this huge strike in 1877, this Chicago rail strike that spreads all over the country. It starts in, well, all over the country by that standards means like Maryland to Illinois, right? And it starts in West Virginia and Western Maryland, and it spreads. And this strike does not go well for the working class. The fucking powers that be are like, well, we have machine guns and we don't care about you. And they were like, could you not kill us? And they're like, that's not an option. And so you have all of these like crazy fiery speeches of all of these socialists who are like, hey, do you want to starve to death and have your entire family starve to death? Or isn't it better to just fucking die fighting cops? And a lot of people are like, yeah, it's fucking better to die fighting cops. However, Albert Parsons is up there giving speeches and he's like, hey, everyone, remember to vote in the next election. And while we're at it, like, you know, don't break anything. We want to have the higher moral ground. And so he's this fucking moderate. And he gets fired. He's actually, even once he's like a wild anarchist, he's like moderate compared to the other anarchists. I love how nothing changes, but we'll get to that. So he gets fired from the newspaper he works for his like wild takes about like the working class shouldn't be shot dead in the streets, but also shouldn't break any laws while they do it or whatever. So Lucy Parsons opens a dressmaking shop and they continue their lives and they're socialists and that's their thing. And they never stop identifying as socialists. This is like a thing that like all words change meanings and stuff like that. At this time, you hadn't had as much of this crazy split. You actually start seeing some of the split between the Marxists and the anarchists, but they're all socialists, like first and foremost, right? And so after the Chicago thing, the moderate socialists kind of lose out. And people are always like, oh, if you stay more moderate, more people will join. This is not what happened in the 1870s in the US. People were like, that moderate shit got us fucking killed. What about fucking dynamite? We could make bombs and throw it at the people who are shooting at us. And so they do. And okay, they do and they don't. It's actually exaggerated how much dynamite was used at the time. There was like a lot of property destruction dynamiting that was happening. Like out in the Washington territory, there was this like landlord who kept evicting people and like both like people who were behind on their mortgage and tenants. And so at some point someone just like dynamited his house or whatever. I don't think he was in it. Anyway, so they become anarchists because there's this new organization. First, there used to be the Internationale, the first international. It started in England. This is the thing that Marx got famous by kind of taking over. He's the guy who like took notes. Yeah. An anarchist showed up at his house to invite his roommate, who is an anarchist, to come to this thing. I'm going to have the details of this slightly wrong. It's been a while since I read this. But like, there was this new working class organization in London. And so this anarchist goes to his anarchist friend's house and is like, oh, I'm going to invite you. But his anarchist friend isn't home and his roommate, he's like, hey, you can come too, Karl Marx. And so Karl Marx comes and joins the International because he was invited by an anarchist. And then he's like, I'll take notes. Never trust the person who quietly wants to take notes. Because he started writing all of the stuff. And anyway, so he pulls some weird shit and they kind of kick out all the anarchists, but that's like the majority of the, like, and so then what's left of the First International falls apart. And it was the International Working Men's Association. So the anarchists, they're like, You know, that was a dumb name in the first place. Because all this PC shit's not fucking new. They started the International Working People's Association, the IWPA, or whatever.
Because anarchists have always... I don't know. It's I found this with, like, researching into the Spanish Civil War, too, where it's, like, all of these things that we think are maybe, like, newer niche to, like, contemporary anarchism or, like, scene or whatever, just...
Yeah.
Absolutely weren't like we have not done we're not doing anything new. I mean, we're doing some things new, but
like some of the ways that we talk about queerness, some of the ways we talk about sex work have changed, but like overall no. Like, and actually one of the ways that a lot of people joined the anarchist contingent of the International was that all of the like socialist feminists were like, can we talk about feminism? And like all the Marxists and shit are like, no, only class. And all the anarchists are like, we don't give a shit. Yeah, fuck yeah, let's talk about it, you know? Although that said, Lucy Parsons herself, totally class reductionist. She was like, yeah, the women issue, whatever. Like, the race issue, whatever. All that fucking matters is class revolution. And that's a little bit of an exaggeration, but she used to get in arguments with Emma Goldman about it. Anyway.
Oh my God, to see those two arguing.
I know, I know. Build a time machine just so I can go like swoon at fucking all of these people giving talks and asking for their autographs or whatever. So, because that's the thing about getting into history is that it's what you do when you get cynical about the current stuff is then you just spend all your time. Anyway, so the International Working People's Association, they sign these protocols, Pittsburgh protocols, Philly protocols. I don't know. It's named after some fucking city. And they basically just like lay out a 5-part program where they're like, let's have a revolution under the following. And we're going to try and have like society look like the following. And it very, there's like only 5 points and one of them is anti-racism and one of them is anti-sexism. And then they, and it's like very autonomous organizing where like each different cluster can kind of do things as they want, but then they all adhere to these following things. It's pretty fucking cool still. And, and they start building a movement with this. And there's a lot of internal discussions and arguments that are very similar to the ones we have now, where there's like some of the more East Coast folks are like, it's funny because Chicago's not East Coast by this standards, even though, anyway.
Chicago's never East Coast by any standards.
Fair enough. So the like more East Coast folks are a little bit more like, what if small groups of people do a lot of violence at night? And then the like... Chicago people are like, what if a mass movement, you know, which spoiler alert came closer to winning, but the neither one won. So we don't know. So they all join the IWPA and they're all fucking organizing and it's mostly immigrants. Lucy and Albert, by being like native born to the US, are kind of exceptional. And a lot of the stuff that's happening, people like to talk about how like white immigrants in the 19th century, especially the Irish and the Italians, weren't white. And this is sort of true and sort of not. They were absolutely racialized and there was like institutional racism against them. They had it better than black people and they were not treated the same as black people in whatever. And however, nativism, this, a lot of what I'm saying, I know, you know, but I'm kind of like doing my whole thing. You know,
Yes.
So there's nativism and it's this anti-immigrant sentiment and it's very similar to what we fucking see now. And it's WASPs. It's white Anglo-Saxon Protestants who are like, we fucking hate the Irish and the German, specifically in Chicago at this time, because there's not as big of an Italian thing, I think. They would have hated the Italians too. And they specifically hate the fucking Catholics on top of everything else, but that's a whole other thing. And so a lot of the anarchists in this particular time and place in that are important to our story are German. And they start building this subculture where you'll appreciate this. They are having anarchist picnics. They are putting on plays. They are rewriting the words to old songs. They are like doing like all kinds of cultural shit. And they're having these crazy militant marches where I think the first gun control law that passed went to the Supreme Court, but I'm not certain about that. But one of the gun control laws that went to the Supreme Court was because you have this German militia named Lehr und Wehr, I don't remember. And they were this German anarchist, socialist militia with a ton of anarchists that would get long guns and parade around the streets. And so then the cops, Illinois, was like, you're no longer allowed to have long guns as part of your militia. And they were like, I read the Constitution And then they were like, let's put it before the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court was like, weird Germans cannot have guns. which sometimes is a safe thing to say, I gotta say, but not in this case. So then they started parading with handguns instead. And so that's your first gun control laws. And they would have like these fucking picnics and stuff. So you have this fucking like beautiful subcultural thing. And they would all hang out in beer halls because that was like the place that German immigrants would organize and stuff like that. And they would do these marches where they would go to the fucking like streets where the rich live. Oh my God. I thought I said I was going to do a 15 minute version. I'm probably doing a 30 minute version. I'm sorry, everyone. I'm not sorry, everyone.
So the second you started talking about Albert Parsons' background, I was like, this is not the 15 minute version.
Yeah. Yep. Sorry, not sorry, everyone. So they would like go to the streets where the rich people lived. And supposedly, I've also read that this particular banner didn't exist, but supposedly they had a banner that said, "Behold your future executioners."
Oh my God. And, someone bring back that banner.
Yes. and so they do all this shit. And then in 1884, the larger labor movement in the U.S., moderates and radicals alike, get together in Chicago. Chicago's kind of one of the hubs of a lot of organizing. And they're like, all right, we're going to have a general strike for the 8-hour workday. And we're going to declare it on May 1st, 1886. Whether or not May 1st was like kind of secretly sort of the pagan like spring renewal kind of thing is the kind of thing a lot of people conjecture about. I don't know.
I don't really see
it either way. And they pick May 1st, 1886, and they're like, we have 2 years to organize a general strike, which is probably about how much time you need to do it. Spontaneous general strikes, you don't need that much time. But spontaneous general strikes don't happen over Twitter, just to let you all know. And
also, the scope of time that we're dealing with is just, it's like the time that it takes information to travel and like organize logistics of like, I absolutely understand. From like an organizer perspective, I absolutely understand why they were like, it's going to take 2 years, you know?
Yeah. I think it would take 2 years now to do it properly. However, again, you can call general strikes when shit is happening and popping off and things can generalize. Strikes can generalize, but calling one, anyway, whatever. So, and at first the anarchists are like, we don't give a shit about the fucking 8-hour workday. We want to end capitalism in the state and like put dynamite in people's houses and shit, you know? And then eventually the anarchists were like, all right, fine. It's what everyone else is doing. I guess we'll do it too. Or they were like, well, we don't believe in a vanguard and this is clearly what everyone else wants. And they're like some of the best organizers in town and they have like, they're some of the most numerous groups too. They like far exceed the Socialist Party at the time. It's a thing that people often forget about. Like we tend to see ourselves as kind of marginal. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that's true. And we have an outsized impact when we are marginal. But anarchists have been the majority movement time and time again across the world, especially before the creation of the USSR. But also again, starting in the 90s. Anyway.
Yeah, it's crazy. Yeah, like what is it like 1 in 10 adults in Barcelona or something were anarchists?
Yeah, it sounds right. It's been a while since I read the Spanish Civil War, but like, I mean, he also, you know, ran all of Catalonia. But yeah, so 2 years go by. On May 1st, some bosses are like, all right, it's a Saturday. Some bosses are like, you can have the fucking 8-hour workday. And other bosses are like, fuck you. And so some people strike and nothing really happens. And then like the first May Day parade in history has at the front this like formerly enslaved black woman and her kids and just fucking makes me happy, you know?
Yeah.
And then come Monday, things get real bad because there's a strike at the McCormick Reaper Harvester. Fuck, I don't know. The fucking McCormick something factory. It's a machine that automates agriculture. And
Harvester.
Yeah, thank you. And so there's scabs there. So people go and like they hear the bell at the end of the day. The scabs are getting off work. So everyone goes to go throw rocks at the scabs. They go throw rock at the scabs, and the problem is that the lumber shovers, which is an anarchist union. I mean, it's also a bunch of anarchist metal workers, and the metal workers union is heavily anarchist at the time and stuff.
Hell yeah.
People throw rocks and shit. The cops start shooting into the crowd. They kill some people, and people are like, is it on? Is this the rev? Should we just fucking go?
Yeah.
And you have this kind of split. Most of what we talk about, for kind of good reasons, the people who wanted people to know what they were doing, most people were like, let's throw a rally tomorrow. My man George Engel and a bunch of other people, he's this toy maker, he's like 50, I have a tattoo of him on my arm. I used to think he was like the quiet, nice guy. Oh my God, no. So, I mean, he's the quiet and nice, but he's one of the most radical people who's ever lived. A bunch of these like older German anarchists, like just like meet in a beer hall with like maps of the city. And they're like, all right, how do we take over the city? Like if they're going to kill us, we should have a Paris commune. We should take over the city. And they were absolutely planning on doing that if things went a certain way. Mm-hmm. The next day, May 4th at Haymarket, which is a fucking square in Chicago. I think there probably used to be a market where people sold hay. That's my best guess without looking it up.
An easy etymology.
Yeah, totally. There was this rally, and it was kind of underwhelming. It was underwhelming because, like, the first flyers that went out were like, come armed, we're going to do this. But that was, like, only a couple of them. And then all the others are like, no, you can't put that on there. We'll all go to jail. And so then the rest were like, just come. Nothing about guns one way or the other. And that's what it said. It's not what it said. And people were like, I don't want to fucking go die. Like, fuck this shit. So a lot of people didn't go. But some, you know, thousands of people went or whatever. And people were giving speeches. And the mayor himself showed up and was like, oh, everything seems chill. It was fine. Some fucking anarchist giving talks. It's kind of a progressive mayor. And it might have been literally a progressive. That was the name of a party at the time.
Okay.
Later, there's going to be a progressive governor who's going to let the remaining Haymarket martyrs out of jail. Or Haymarket defendants out of jail. The ones who were not martyred. So, and the mayor's like, it's fine. He goes to the chief of police, who's like a fucking, he's a blood and justice. I like beating everyone up and I don't care about the law guy. He's a cop's cop. And he's like, hey, call off your goon squad. We're going to fucking, everything's fine. And the chief of police is like, whatever, you're not the boss of me. And the mayor's like, yeah, I am.
He's like, yeah, literally.
Yeah, that conversation didn't happen, but the thing happened where the chief of police did completely ignore the mayor.
Totally.
And so then this, Albert Parsons gives a speech. He's kind of this, I get this impression that Albert Parsons is kind of a self-important douchebag. and he's like kind of like, he's like kind of liberal on the anarchy side, and that's fine. Like, I mean, I'm honestly kind of liberal on the anarchy side. But like, he goes up and he gives a speech for like a fucking hour. I just don't want to hear. That's why I decided I didn't like him, is he gave a speech for an hour and I don't want to go an hour long speech, even though I'm now talking for 30 minutes. So I don't know, whatever, but you dear listener, like mowing the lawn or driving across the border with an, anyway.
Maybe also, sorry, just quick. Can I?
Yeah. You telling me to hurry
espouse
up?
A speculation about Albert Parsons.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know too much about Albert Parsons. Beyond what you have told me. But I think it's like this thing that makes me wonder if I have no clue why Albert Parsons was moderate, you know, maybe he was. And I feel like because of stuff that I know that he dealt with, like during the trial and like during the, or in like after the trial awaiting, the gallows, like, it's like, I don't want to say he was a coward or anything, but like, I wonder if because he fought an entire war, he like wanted to avoid that at all costs, you know?
That honestly,
because he knew how horrifying it was.
That's
which I don't know if that's
possible.
True.
No, it's
pure
possible.
Speculation.
I mean, it's interesting because Lucy Parsons in her rhetoric, and they're different people, but in her rhetoric, she talks a lot about how people tend to view abolitionist movement and the labor movement as like two totally separate things. It was like, oh, we had abolitionists and then we had socialists and there's no overlap. And that's
people
just
don't
not
understand
true.
How movements work or social scenes work.
Yeah. Like several of the, well, at least one of the Haymarket martyrs, I think he's one of the defendants, he like came to the US as a traveling Methodist preacher in order to talk about the emancipation of Black people and like wound up an anarchist. And, you know, Albert Parsons, of course, and Lucy Parsons got their start a little bit pretty invested in all this stuff pretty directly. And then John Brown's son wrote the defendants and sent them like a basket of fruit or flowers or something, and basically was like, my dad would have been with you all. My dad would have been a socialist. He talked about how what he wanted was like cooperatives and you know, would have been an anti-authoritarian socialist by like modern standards, like 20 years later
yeah.
or whatever.
Yeah.
As his son understood it, and his son would probably fucking know. But Albert Parsons was kind of a moderate in that he like, when I say moderate, I mean, he was an anarchist and he wanted the overthrow of capitalism in the state. But there's things like, I'll get to it. Okay, so they have this protest, and then the cops show up and they're like gonna bust up the thing. And they probably were gonna shoot people, but we don't know for sure. Because some dude, probably a German dude, probably a German anarchist who got away with it, was like, I got a fucking dynamite, and he threw it at the cops. And he killed one of the cops, and then the cops opened fire and then killed a bunch of other cops, as well as a bunch of people in the crowd.
That's like, right. I forgot they killed a bunch of themselves.
Yeah, like probably all of the other cops that died that night, which is, don't get me wrong, I would be like, and then we fucking killed some of them too, if we had, right? But there's not a lot of evidence for that, and there's a lot of like forensic evidence that implies that it was like most of the gunfire was coming from the police. I believe not all of it. Albert Parsons was like a Pinkerton, a private security guard of the like the boss class. That's who threw the bomb. It was an agent provocateur, you know, to bring down the wrath of the state against the workers.
That's why
I'm calling him a moderate.
Yeah, I see.
And like, and the other reason, okay, the three groups of people roughly in the anarchist scene, because it's an anarchist scene, so they all hate each other.
Yeah, of course.
And so you have Albert Parsons runs The Alarm, which is the English language newspaper. And then one of the other guys, Spies, August Spies, runs Arbeiter Zeitung. He runs Workers' Paper in German. And it's the like moderate anarchist German paper. You have to go way back in time to where you can start talking about moderate anarchists, and because you're still talking about anarchists. But as compared to, and actually we still have these splits now, no one ever calls themselves a moderate anarchist. Then you have Der Anarchist, which is the other German paper. And they're the people who were like George Engel and those people who are like, all right, how do we fucking take over the city? Whereas August Spies is like putting on the like, hey, everyone, let's have a big public meeting, you know? So that's the kind of split. And so George Engel wasn't on fucking speaking terms with August Spies and Albert Parsons, because he's like, these fucking, we all know these people in our own scenes, right? We're like, oh, that person doesn't talk to that person because that person's too radical and that person's too liberal. And I don't give a shit. They both come to my parties, but then they stare at each other, you know?
And somehow they ended up co-defendants in a conspiracy trial.
Yep.
And also something we're absolutely not familiar with in our day and age. Yep.
And it kind of shuts up their argument, you know? It kind of puts things in perspective. So the bomb gets thrown. And the city goes fucking, the state, the government goes haywire and just arrests fucking everybody. They're raiding everything. They're like literally like, arrest people now, look up the laws later. And they're like torturing people for information. And they're like abusing Lucy Parsons' children. And it's bad, right? Albert Parsons goes on the run. A socialist guy hides him in Wisconsin, I think at like a cheese farm or something like that. The guy who threw the bomb is like, I'm fucking out of here.
Yeah, whoever.
No one knew who he was until about the 19, like, 80s or whenever the fuck Paul Avrich wrote his book about Haymarket. He's the guy who kind of solved that cold case, which is fine to do once it's a cold case and everyone's dead. But until then.
Yes.
So they put 10 people on trial. One of them turned state's evidence, so his like name is dead to history. No one fucking mentions it. And then one dude is like, I'm fucking out of here. And he like a combination of Canadian anarchists and indigenous people secret him away to Canada and then get him to South America where he lives out the rest of his life. And he's the one that the newspapers are like, oh, is totally this guy And it just wasn't. But he wasn't going to show up and be like, yeah, I didn't do it. He was like, I'm fucking out of here.
Yeah.
Albert.
The hammer's coming down.
Yeah. Albert Parsons, not a coward. He turns himself in to stand trial because he thinks there's no real evidence against him and he'll be able to have his day in court and show true justice, is my general guess. It seems like he thought on some core level, he thought that the American system would like kind of come through for him.
You know, I was kind of not like hitting Albert Parsons as like a different flavor where I was like, oh, you poor fool.
Yeah.
And now I'm like, you poor fool.
But he also, and so it was a little bit that, and I think it was a little bit like, I have to go stand with my people.
Yeah.
Like, and he goes, there's this trial. And one of the things that I actually find really interesting and beautiful about the Haymarket affair, there's this class of people who stood up for the Haymarket anarchists who were the tiny percentage of people who actually believed in law. Because the people who are the prosecutors and judges and jury and everyone, they're really open about like, we don't give a shit that none of these people threw the bomb. We're going to, and they don't even accuse them of conspiracy or incitement. They get convicted of murder.
Yeah.
And they're very upfront. They're like, anarchy is on trial today.
Mm-hmm.
Their lawyer is this believes in law guy who absolutely tanked his career. He knew it. He was like, I will never work again if I defend these people, but I have to because I believe in law and I have respect for that. And so this fucking paladin basically steps up and defends them. And it's a Southerner who had fought for the North when he was a teenager. He actually caught on to shit before our man Parsons did. And he had already like fucked over his reputation with his family by doing what was right. So he's a guy, William Black, maybe. He's a guy who's like not afraid of doing what he believes is right. And they just,
where is the court drama movie about this? I want a court drama movie.
It would be so good. And honestly, and you could do that low budget. You need good actors, but most of the writing is in the books.
Yeah. Like,
you need really fucking good actors, but most of it could happen in the fucking courtroom.
Yeah.
You know, you probably gotta do the Haymarket scene. I don't know, whatever.
Yeah.
So they get found guilty. Seven of them are sentenced to hang. One of them gets 15 years. His last speech, I think that's Neeb. His last speech is like, just fucking kill me. What the fuck? Like, my kids will be able to come to my grave and it'll mean more to them than coming to see me in jail forever or whatever, you know?
Yeah.
And then there's this whole thing where like the governor is like, there's this clemency campaign. And it, during the trial, all of the press is like, we fucking hate the anarchists. Fuck them. But then Lucy Parsons and a bunch of other people go on tour all around the country and they're like, hey, this is a travesty. And a lot of people, including like moderates and right-wing people, are like, oh, you can't convict people of murder who didn't kill people, you know? And so it gets starts being seen as a travesty of justice while they're awaiting execution. And they're awaiting for about a year. One of them, August Spies, gets married while he's in jail to this like heiress who loses her inheritance to her family to marry this guy that she's like, they're only able to like kiss once through the bars. He can't even attend his own fucking wedding. His brother like stands in his place. And his brother had pushed him out of the way and gotten shot in the dick during the Haymarket affair to save his brother's life. And then stands in for him for his wedding. And that lady, she spends the rest of her life involved in social struggle. And like ends up like this, like poor cat lady who's like in her, you know, 60s and 70s, like going to demonstrations and shit. When I say poor cat lady, I don't mean like poor cat lady. Like she just doesn't have any money and she's a cat lady. So yeah. She's cool as shit. It's like two good things is what I'm describing. So
yeah,
And they all give these fucking baller speeches at the end of the trial. Some of them don't even speak English. And I think it's, oh, I don't remember which one of the Germans does all the talking for the other ones who don't speak German. One of them, and they're all like cool in their own ways, but like shout out Louis Ling, who was 23 when he died. He was 21 when the bomb got thrown, and his fucking alibi was, I couldn't have thrown the bomb. I was at home making bombs.
The best line ever.
Yeah.
The best line no author could ever write ever.
I know. On the other hand, the like New York Times was like, when the cops came to arrest him, I think they came for his roommate and he was like there. So they were like, fuck it, we'll take you. And so he tried to kill the cop and he like stole the cop's gun and tried to shoot him or something like that. And then in the carriage, according to the New York Times, he was like, it all would have been worth it if only I'd been able to kill that police officer. And like, I wouldn't put it past Louis Ling. He did not speak enough English for that to have been written down. That is some fucking propaganda from the New York Times.
But it's like propaganda where it's like, it's supposed to be propaganda, like, ooh, bad. And like, you hear it and you're like, that's great.
And what I like about this group of this cross section of anarchism, I want to say it's like five German immigrants, one English man, and one American. But they're like, have different politics from each other. They came at it from different ways. Most of them went through socialism first. Like most of them tried working within the system. And then they were like, I have to do what's right. And then one of the things that like all of them get written about, including the most radical ones, is that they're all like scrupulously honest. And so they were just like really forthright about what they believed and what they thought was right. And so a bunch of them, they're all offered that if they write to the governor for clemency, it might be granted after all of this work that everyone's done.
Yeah.
And some of them write for clemency and most of them don't. August Spies actually writes for clemency. And then he's like, wait, no, fuck you, actually. Yeah. Albert Parsons writes and is like, I will not ask you for clemency. If I am innocent, let me go. And Louis Ling is like, because this case went to the Supreme Court. Louis Ling is like, take my fucking name off the Supreme Court. I don't give a shit. Fuck this system. And there's this heartbreaking, it's actually the only thing I want to look up as a quote. There's this heartbreaking line. This is just from the zine. I'm going to read one paragraph from the zine. Okay, so Louis Ling kills himself in jail. He gets smuggled a bunch of bombs and one version of the story that I've heard is that the guy who smuggled him a bunch of bombs was this guy that everyone else saw as like a useless liberal anarchist, like academic who never fucking lifted a finger in his life. It's like if Noam Chomsky has smuggled you fucking bombs in jail, you know?
Incredible. Who doesn't like, want to be smuggled bombs by Noam Chomsky?
Yeah, because everyone's like, oh, we don't got to search that guy. It's fucking Noam Chomsky. He's the boring kind of anarchist, you know? Mm-hmm. But they find the bombs. But they don't find is a blasting cap. And I've heard that it was like left over from the bombs. I've also heard that it was smuggled in later in a cigar, whatever. He bit down on the blasting cap and it took about 24 hours for him to slowly bleed to death.
Oh my God.
And a quote from my own zine. A few days before he died, his mother and aunt had written to him. His mother wrote, I will be as proud of you after your death as I have been during your life. His aunt wrote, whatever happens, even the worst, show no weakness before those wretches.
Wow. That's a hard quote.
I know. And like, I love that he was supported by the older women in his family with his like, you know, because people have this like perception of all of this as youthful rebellion. Instead of people who've been through quite a lot and believe what they're doing is right and are part of a culture that also believes what they're doing is right. And so four of them get hanged. There's four of them left to die. August Spies says there will come a time when our silence will be more powerful than the voices you strangle today. Engel shouted in German, hoch die Anarchie, or hurrah for anarchy. More literally, it's up the anarchy, which is also cool.
Up the punks.
And it makes me wonder whether up the punks comes from hawk the punks or something like that.
I have to believe. I will, you know, I'll dig into it. Okay. I'm the etymology nerd.
Yeah. Fischer, another one of these. I'll go through their last words. But then Fischer shouted also in German, hurrah for anarchy. This is the happiest day of my life. And then Parsons said the most Parsons thing possible as his last words, which is, "Will I be allowed to speak, O men of America? Let me speak. Sheriff Mattson, let the voice of the people be heard. Oh!" And then that's all he got out before the trap opened underneath them.
I mean,
and one of the things that happened during the lead up in the trial is that the bomber, who had gotten over, I think, to Boston, maybe New York, I don't remember, he like either showed up or wrote a letter or something. He corresponded with people and was like, "Should I come back? Like, should I come stand trial? Will that save these people's lives?"
Yeah.
And they thought about it. And only some of the defendants knew this. It was Engel and it was probably Fisher. It was the Dare Anarchist crowd, the like the hardcore, right? They knew who the bomber was by the end. I don't think they knew at the time during the trial. And they were like, "No, you'd just be one more corpse." And he was like, "Okay." And he didn't come back. And when they were hanging them, the cops like treated, they hung them in the prison and they like surrounded the like a fucking fortress with like Gatling guns and shit. And all the media was like, "The anarchists are gonna storm the prison." Because we were.
Yeah. Yeah.
There was a plan to. And then
easy guess.
Yeah. And then the anarchists who were condemned said, "No, like, let us go. You know, so many more of you will die. We appreciate it. But no." Their funeral march had 20,000 people and 200,000 onlookers, which is the largest funeral ever seen in Chicago, at least at that time. And they started May Day, the workers' holiday. And it was interesting because the anarchist scene fell apart in Chicago as a result of this. The anarchist scene in the U.S., it's a little bit of a crapshoot, a little bit of like this and that about whether or not it... But the anarchist scene and socialism in general were incredibly bolstered internationally by what happened. And their martyrdom like mattered immediately. And you could go into like cafes anywhere in the world and you would see portraits of these men. And I'm not like a big like, we shouldn't seek martyrdom, but we shouldn't be afraid of claiming our martyrs, is how I feel about it. Anyway, that was not a 15-minute version of the story.
50 minutes later. I mean, it's not a... I mean, it's not a small tale, you know? It's absolutely not a small tale.
Because I had always heard the small tale of it, and it was, like, fine. I was like, "Oh, yeah, like, some guys went hard. That's neat."
Yeah.
But, like, until you have the, like, this is what his aunt said. And, like, this is how they went on huge marches. And, you know, like, I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's like a lot. It's like a lot of the small details that like when we don't have the whole story, it gets easy to forget kind of why it's important, you know?
Yeah.
Because it's like, I had always heard like, it's like, oh, Haymarket, like it's some people got martyred, someone threw a bomb. And you know, that's all you ever hear about it.
Yeah. Like sounds messy. Maybe they shouldn't have thrown the bomb.
Yeah.
Which
yeah.
is probably true, but whatever. Like,
yeah, but it's so much bigger than that. And it's like the having a prelude or having like all of these little pieces of it, like having the larger picture really makes it a story that like has more context, has more, and which gives it more resonance for right now, like, which is kind of my I have a first question, but I have a silly tie-in. Do you know, anarchists throughout history, they fucking love circle bombs. This is a story about some people who loved circle bombs. You know, there's this this predates the Spanish Civil War, but there's this food in Spain called la bombas tapas. And it was invented by an anarchist who ran a like pub and was trying to get creative with potatoes, you know? And didn't invent anything. Like it was just a potato croquette. But it was this dish that became really popular in Spain in the, like the 1910-20 times. And it's called La Bombas Tapas. And it's a potato croquette filled with like meat and cheese or like whatever. Mm-hmm. And it had a little aioli drizzle or a fuse. And it was served in a small dish of marinara or blood.
Hell yeah.
It was this very popular food before the Spanish Civil War.
August Spies kept an empty circle bomb on his desk when he like he worked for Arbiter Zeitung. He like worked like 12, 16 hour days or whatever. And so he's just like furiously typing at his desk, probably had a green visor on, I don't know. But he had a fucking circle bomb. Remember what he's fighting for.
That's wonderful. I work with this theater troupe here. We put on weird gay plays, and we did a version of Henry IV, but as the Spanish Civil War.
Is that available online for people to see yet?
No, it will be at some point. And I'll definitely talk about it more here when it is. But we do have a recording of it this year, and it's a fun little thing. But I'm proud of myself for this. We came up, me and one of my co-directors came up with this pun to name the bar. We named the bar where all the anarchists hang out Bar El Bomba Bear, Bomba Bear being a composite word of like bomb and beber, meaning to drink. So you could you could call it the Bar of Good Drinking, or you could call it, it's Bomba Bear also sounds like the word bombardier.
Yeah.
Which is also kind of what it is in Spanish. And so it's either Bar of Good Drinking or Bar of the Bomb Throwers.
Hell yeah.
And it's where all the anarchists hang out in our fictional version of historical Barcelona.
There was this bar in Amsterdam when I lived there called the Molly. And it was like short, you know, the Molotov or whatever, right?
Oh, okay. And hell yeah.
And it was this anarchist bar, and I was gonna start this punk band just to put out a 45, and only half the people I met thought this was funny. Where I wanted one side was gonna be Molly at the Cops, and then the other side was gonna be Cops at the Molly. And so it'd just be for the art, where the Molly at the Cops would be like a like cute girl who's probably named Molly, like standing in the police station holding a Molotov behind her back. And then Cops at the Molly would be like cops drinking at the Molly with everyone looking aghast and staring confused.
Oh my God.
But a lot of my friends there are pretty literal and didn't have a sense of humor that worked with my sense of humor, and did not approve of Molly at the Cops at the Molly as a anyway.
Unfortunate. Yeah. But aside from fun tie-ins, I guess it's just kind of some tie-up questions. Although I have some ideas about this, but you were the person being interviewed. Why is Remembering May Day? Why is this important for us today? Like, what do we currently have to, what should we remember? How should we remember this?
So I'm going to go with why. I'm going to start with why we should remember it, which is, there is this problem of like nostalgia for the golden age of anarchism, right? Which would be roughly like 1880, probably 1886 to about 1917, or maybe up to 1936, depending on how you're counting, right? Where we were the majority movement and all over the world, and we were so close and blah, 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 right? And I fall into some of that nostalgia sometimes. But the answer to that isn't rejecting caring about those things, because we shouldn't live in the past, but it really helps to know that we come from somewhere. Like, there's something that I think about all the time, where the Spanish Civil War, you know, 1936, 1939 or whatever, like, was one of the high water marks of anarchism, and some of the people who were fighting in that struggle were probably fourth generation anarchists.
Yeah.
Because could have been sixth generation anarchists, because anarchism had been growing as a culture and a community since 70 years earlier, you know? And I think that it is worth understanding that that is possible, that we don't have to have these like clean breaks with the past where we have to start all over again. And when we can know that we come from something, I think there's a lot of beauty and meaning. And I also think that there's our heritage is not just blood. You know, our heritage, anarchism has always been about internationalism. And I think, this is an easy thing for me to say as a white person in the United States, I think we can look at the Japanese anarchists trying to kill the emperor to free Korea and be like, that's us. You know, I think we can look at these like struggles in Argentina, you know, the rebellion in Patagonia, where we took over a huge chunk of southern part of Argentina, where they also had bomb named pastries because the Bakers Union an anarchist union. And I can look at that and say, like, that's us, you know, like we did that. And we can do more. And we are part of something that happens all over the world and take pride in it. And I also think because our history is like specifically erased as anarchists, queers, like anyone who's been on the losing side of some historical stuff, like our history is fucking erased. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons they manage to erase our history is that they kill us a lot. There's been a lot of like sawtooth of history stuff happening where, you know, we're going, we're building over the course of generations, and then they like kill us all, or they drive us underground, or, you know, people are too afraid in the Soviet Union to admit that they were anarchists or that their parents were anarchists or whatever, you know? And I think that we can undo some of that work that has been done against us, this like erasing of our history. And I also think we can see ourselves in history, and we can, the kind of like how we're joking about like, oh, anarchists never change or whatever. Like there's like a fucking essay from like 1910 or I don't remember the name of it. I just remember reading this. It's like this old essay that's like, hey, could you please stop stealing from the anarchist bookstore? And I'm like, I could have written that in 2005, you know? It just like helps humanize like us as part of a, also because like anarchism, you know, I think anarchism is aspirational in that, like, I believe in the positive project of trying to create an anarchist society. But overall, at the end of the day, anarchism is a thing we do, right? Yeah. Rather than a thing that we, like, create, you know? You know, anarchism is a verb. Well, anarchism isn't a verb, but whatever. You know, let's pretend it is. And yeah. I think that we can see ourselves. Oh, how do I express this? I named this album I did called Always Forever. And it comes from this like piece of weird propaganda that someone had made like 15 years ago, where a bunch of riot footage of people like running and all this stuff. And it's like, you know, things building up. And then eventually it's just this crowd moving and it flashes always and forever, always forever, always forever. We've always been here. This like yearning for collective freedom has always been part of the human animal. And we can be part of this permanent, beautiful motion. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I got. What do you got? I want to hear your take on this.
I mean, yeah, a lot of what you've said, or I agree with everything that you've said. I think it's important to remember these stories because, and especially because of some of these details where it's like, okay, like if the stories that kind of like the world is telling about anarchism is like, oh, these like bomb obsessed freaks who are just like trying to like mow down cops and shit like that. And I'm like, well, and you know, kind of, but it's
not
like
our main thing.
No, but it's like, but also we have to, it's like, we have to contextualize that within this idea that like people adopted that kind of violence, not out of nowhere. It's because like you said, it's like people were getting gunned down in the streets. Like people were dying, like, like communities were being ripped apart by the police, by the state, like, and because of, I can assume the how real they thought the threat of anarchism was. And I think it's important for us to remember how afraid the state was of us.
That is a really good point.
Yeah.
We have quotes about it. We have like one of the general, there's like a US general that's like, a war's coming between the rich and the poor. We got to put them in their place or they're going to kill us all.
Yeah. And it's like the world that we live in now, it's like the societal context that we have is that like we have people fighting. We have people fighting who shouldn't be fighting. We have a lot of people fighting who shouldn't be fighting. We have a lot of people fighting who could be finding community with each other and could be
We have a culture war instead of a class war.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. We have a culture war instead of a class war. And which it's like, you know, I'm not a class reductionist. I think this stuff is so complicated and we have to acknowledge the complexities and also like try to move past some of them so that we can like not get fucking killed by the state. Yeah. And it's weird that that is the dream. The dream is to not get killed by the state.
Yeah.
And it's stories like the stories of Mayday where like we have these vibrant cultures, we have these vibrant intergenerational cultures communities that were like utterly ripped apart by events like the Haymarket murders, you know, by events like Sacco and Vanzetti, by events like the Spanish Civil War. And it's like when I think of like these like intergenerational, vibrant, filled with all different kinds of people, migrant-led communities, and then seeing how those communities were utterly torn apart, and how we, like, because, you know, me growing up in anarchist or coming into anarchism as a young person, like, there weren't intact intergenerational communities of anarchists.
Yeah.
We didn't have that, and so it's like hearing these stories makes me remember that world happened and that it can happen again.
Yeah.
And that we can win.
In Spain you would go to anarchist scouts. Because your anarchist parents would be like, well, we need something that you can do while we're at work, because we work all the time because of fucking capitalism. And good thing that there's this place we could drop off our kids after school. I don't know if it's after school program, but like, you know, it can be a rebellious culture, but not necessarily an internally rebellious culture. You know, you don't have to rebel against your parents necessarily. I mean, if your parents are anarchists or whatever, I don't know, whatever. Knowing that we are, because also we're coming around to the same, like the class setup in the United States looks more right now than it, like the 1880s, than anything else that I can imagine. Because it's like, that's the era of robber barons. This is the era where there was like suddenly a marked difference between the rich and the poor. I mean, there's always been a difference, but you know, this is the era of like these industry tycoons and like
proto billionaires.
Yeah. And there's also like, okay, there's a technology part of it. The reason that anarchists were obsessed with dynamite, which is not something I believe we should replicate. I think that one of the things that they learned from this period was individual acts of violence rarely progress a movement forward. Not never, very rarely. Yeah. But dynamite was this new technology that suddenly allowed individuals to express an awful lot of destructive force in a way that like they had never been able to do before. I don't know why I'm talking about that. I'm just thinking about the.
That's Are you going to talk about how we need a
nope,
block
not
of
about anything about now? Nope, there's nothing now. Anyone could? Nope.
Or sorry, I'm not going anywhere sketchy. I'm not going somewhere.
Okay.
Sketchy.
Okay. Cool.
Yeah. I was gonna say a block hackers, hacker block, trans hacker blocks of the. Okay, wait. So I don't know if anyone has seen The People's Joker. This is my. I just have to say something about this movie.
I haven't seen this movie.
Kind of incredible, and would go see if it's in your if you can find it. But at some point there's this quote where the main character is like, I don't know, we'll hack Bruce Wayne's fucking drones. We'll hack them. Like someone in here is a hacker. Like it's a bar filled with trans people and incels. Like we're going to hack shit.
Hell yeah. Like,
Oh my God. And then they do. Then they hack Bruce Wayne's fucking drones. And it's great.
I actually think that hacking probably would be the technological thing that is mostly being used for bad that does allow individuals to exert certain types of power that the state is afraid of. The state is very afraid. Hacktivism doesn't seem to be, maybe I'm just out of these circles. Hacktivism doesn't seem to be as big of a thing now as it was in like the aughts, but it could and should be bigger. Now it's easy for me to say since I'm not going to be doing it, but
yeah. Nor would we ever advocate for anyone doing anything that is illegal.
I mean, it's funny because a lot of my like non-advocacy of certain things is because it's more of a I don't want to tell people what to do. You know, it's like kind of a like, well, like no one should, I can't in good conscience tell anyone to take risks that I'm not taking.
Yeah.
The thing I could say is that I would work on people's legal defense campaigns, but I would not be in a good position to tell people whether or not it's a good idea, like ethically, materially, legally, you know, strategically.
Yeah.
But
anyways, to get away from talking about questionable things. So that kind of brings us to the end of our time. Do you have any last thoughts on May Day? Do you have any ways that you like to celebrate May Day? Whether there are things that you're actually going to do or things that you wish or hope that you we're doing.
My favorite thing to do is to go to like anarchist picnics on May Day. I actually really like, I understand why people make a lot of things conflictual. For May Day itself, I really like having a celebratory day where we like eat in the park, where we have teach-ins, where we just like hang out and like celebrate. It's like anarchist pride day, you know? And then I also like that it ties into then figure out what immigrant communities in your area are doing to celebrate May Day and how can you support them without fucking up their shit. Without like having to be like, oh, like we don't matter, so we have to be quiet and only do what they want. But like instead be like, no, these are like, there's multiple groups of people who have very valid claims on this amazing and beautiful day. How can we just be in community together? I love May Day. I don't know exactly where I'm going to be this one. Oh, I do know where I'll be a couple days after. Is this going to come out before or after May Day?
On May Day.
Oh, well, if you're in the Triangle area of North Carolina, I'll be at a couple different May Day events this weekend. You'll hear me do exactly the same spiel about May Day that I already did. And then you'll hear me talk about preparedness. If you want.
Hell yeah.
You don't have to.
Hell yeah. Do you have anything else to plug or places that people can find you on the internet where you would like to be found?
Yeah, I write a lot on Substack these days. I write a new essay every week. Recent one about the patterns that movements take and how they succeed and fail, called Casting Fire. I'm pretty proud of that piece. But I don't know, also like, go join movements instead of paying attention to me.
Cool. Well, that brings us to our last little part of the podcast, which is the word of the month.
Yay!
Any guesses about what the word of the month this month is going to be?
La Croix.
What does that word mean? What?
It's when you pronounce La Croix, but like you're trying to speak French.
Okay. You know,
cross, I think.
Yeah.
No, which, that's not what it's going to be about.
No, it's not what it's going to be about. But
I don't know. I literally looked for the nearest object and I have some bubbly water on the table. I have no idea what it's going to be. Wait, if it's about May Day.
It's,
Is it anarchy?
It's a funny tie. No, it's not anarchy. Anarchy actually has a fairly, it's a fairly lackluster etymology.
All right.
But some words with not, with pretty on the basis, like lackluster etymologies, do have really interesting kind of stories behind them. And that's kind of our word today. And I bring this, the tie-in for this word is that it's like there, I can imagine that when a lot of this was happening on both sides, it's like there was a lot of this. And the word today is panic. And I have
the
maybe,
God Pan. Does it relate to the God Pan?
It relates to the God Pan. Yeah.
Yes.
You got it. You got the word of the month. You're the first person to guess the word of the month meaning. But yeah, panic meaning like a sudden mass terror. It literally it comes from the Greek word panikon or panikos, meaning pertaining to Pan. And the kind of the story, the larger story behind this is that like Pan was a deity that was like the absolute embodiment of chaotic neutral, you know, didn't give a fuck, just wanted to see wacky stuff happen, you know? And so Pan would appear to like go to like wars and stuff, like pitched battles, and just like pick a random side and like show up as like a terrifying monster or as like a squadron of cavalry or just like make terrifying noises. And the goal was to cause people to be confused. It was to and to panic. And you know, Pan wasn't known to choose sides, like didn't really care. And would also do this to like wayward travelers in the woods, would make like terrifying noises to cause people to like flee in a panicked state. And the tie-in for this word is that like when I think about when the bomb was thrown, this moment of like sheer mass panic.
Yeah, that's just Pan. The person who threw it was just Pan, just an embodiment of Pan. It wasn't good for our side. It wasn't bad for our side. It just happened.
Yeah.
Sorry, I got excited.
Oh no, that's great. I love it. That's what I was gonna say. I love it. I love it. And yeah, it's like it's not a good thing. It's not a bad thing. I kind of wish I had a more joyous word to celebrate May Day with, but this is maybe my cautionary tie-in. Is that like, I don't know, we do have a lot of weird, hard times ahead of us. And I think it is an important thing for us to learn that like the panic that we're going to feel in these like coming times and now is like something, we got to make sure we're fighting the right people.
Yeah.
Which is not ourselves.
And also, okay, this idea of like just what you can do with just confusion. There's this thing that like people talk about in like sort of tactical spaces. Have you heard of the Oda loop?
No.
There's this thing, it's like a study of what people do in crisis or like in battle, in like heightened situations, which is that your brain goes through a loop. The Oda loop is observe, orient, decide, and act. And you have to, the argument is that you have to do all of these things before you can do the next thing, before you can act, right? When you just do weird, confusing shit, you break your people's Oda loop. Like, it's the equivalent of like, you ever seen the videos of like someone's trying to start a fight with someone, and so they're like, all right, let's fucking go, and they like drop their pants. And then people are like,
yes.
What?
Yes.
You're breaking their Oda loop. You're breaking their, like, they're like, I don't know what's happening anymore. You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And so sometimes just like weird, surreal shit just fucks, like, I don't know. Anyway, I think
this is
like,
how I
go.
This is how I dealt with bullying as a child.
Yeah. Just do weird shit.
Yeah, this is how I dealt with like people wanting to enact like fearful violence upon me.
Yeah.
Because I was not strong.
Yeah.
But yeah, also there's these you know, Pan are just now definition of Pan is that Pan's kind of an asshole. But Pan also had a cult. Like the cult of Pan is like fairly interesting in that like they would Pan is like a chthonic deity, often meaning that like these deeper older connections, because there's like this break in Greek mythology between like the chthonic deities and the sky deities. The sky deities being newer,
like and Zeus
like Zeus and Ares and all the basic Olympians. Yeah, they're fucking boring. Yeah. And Pan was a chthonic deity, and so you could trace a lot of the ties to that for like a lot deeper, a lot more of these like kind of like connections to the earth, etc. And a part of the thing that the cult of Pan would do is that they would just go out to the mountains and like get high and like ecstatic dance for days.
Hell yeah.
And there was like, I presenting this like really negative aspect of like panic, which is that it's like, you know, it's harmful, it's confusing, it's terrifying for a good reason. And also that like panic was something that people embraced and like reveled in. And that was a form of like, not resistance isn't the right word, but kind of like counterculture to like the societies that were being built at the time, is to like go out to the mountains, get high, dance with your friends, embrace terror and panic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love
it. Be confusing.
Confuse yourself so that you're no longer thinking in the same way, so that you come out of it thinking different things than you went in. And when you're trapped and you can't come up with any ideas, yeah, shuffle your brain around. Not physically.
Yeah, which I kind of see as like some of the martyrs like speeches that I've like read more about is like speeches to the court or just like the ways that they were inhabiting those situations is like, to me, completely non-rational. They are not acting in like they're not acting in a way that's like easy to do. And it's like, I try to imagine what those people were going through as they're like, I know this isn't going to work out for me. I know this is a farce, and I'm going to be staunch and like stalwart in court. I'm not going to fucking beg for my life.
Yeah.
And like, and I can imagine how strange and like off-putting that could have been for like imagine attending that trial and like seeing these people just be like, I didn't throw it, but I would.
Yeah, totally. I think though that like, I think one of the things that we're fucked by is we're fucked by like a couple hundred years of individualism. And I don't mean I know it's a contentious word and individualist anarchism is legitimate and whatever, but like this idea that like what matters is the continuation of like my personal existence or whatever as like the only thing with true value, and everything else is like falls off from there, as compared to like so many cultures all around the world have either inverted that or put them on the same level. And I think that once you're like fucked, you know, once you're on trial for a murder you didn't do and you know you're going down, it is time to switch your mode of thinking completely and be like, okay, what matters right now is not whether I live or die, because I'm going to die, you know? And I think that that's like magic in kind of a similar way you're talking about like panic, like this, like, I mean, I think that's what you're getting at. Like,
yeah. Yeah.
Where we can reframe the way we think about certain things. And I don't know. Yeah. No, I like it. It's a good word.
Yeah, it is a good word. Well, any last words? Not like last words, like Albert Parsons' last
Hawk
words,
the
but
anarchy.
Like last words. Like,
will I be allowed to speak? Oh.
Thanks so much for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, then celebrate May Day. Even if you're not listening on May Day, every day is May Day now. Also, if you liked it, you can tell people about the show. You can rate and review and like and subscribe, or whatever the algorithm calls for. Feed it like a hungry god. However, if you want to support us in other sillier ways that don't involve feeding a nameless and mysterious entity, and unless it's Pan, you know, go feed the... Well, Pan has a name. Pan is not nameless. Pan is mysterious. Anyways, if you enjoy this podcast, go ecstatic dance to a strange deity in the mountains with your friends. It will be a blast. Or you could consider supporting the show financially by subscribing to our Patreon. If you subscribe to our Patreon at $10 a month, we'll mail you a zine version of the pieces that you hear here every month, anywhere in the world. You can also get access to an archive of Old Strangers content, as well as discounts on things like t-shirts and books we publish. Find us at patreon.com/strangersinatangledwilderness. You can also find other podcasts we put out, like The Spectacle, the podcast for people who love movies and hate cops. But before we go, we would like to shout out some of our patrons as part of our Patreon acknowledgments tier. If you would like us to thank you, someone you love, a rad organization, or a theoretical and fictional concept, then subscribe to Patreon for $20 a month, and I will thank whatever you ask me to. Unless it's something that's really bad. I'm not going to do it. Thank you, Alium, Amber, Ephemeral, Appalachian Liberation Library, Portland's Hedron Hackerspace, Boldfield, E. Batoli, Eric, Buck, Julia, Catgut, Marm, Carson, Lord Harkin, Trickster, Miranda, Ben Ben, Anonymous, Funder, Janice and Odell, Allie, Paparuna, Milica, Boise Mutual Aid, Theo, Hunter, SJ, Paige, Nicole, David, Dana, Chelsea, Starro, Jennifer, Kirk, Chris, Micaiah, and Haas the dog. Thank you so much for your support. It means so much to us and has allowed us to get so much done as a collective. And lastly, a lot of these features on the podcast come from listeners like you. So if you feel like a stranger that would like to find their story home in this tangled wilderness, consider submitting it. We await to huzzah it. Next month, we have a poetry collection by Maria L. called Escape Plan. Stay well. We hope you come back.